From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we are coming up on July 1st, which is a critical day for businesses and governments. For many, it's the beginning of the new fiscal year. And in Illinois, July 1st would mark 2 years without a budget. The Republican Governor Bruce Rauner has been at odds with the Democratic legislature. And for the last 9 days, they've been in a special legislative session to try to hammer out a deal. Here's Rauner.
So once again, we ask lawmakers to please do what is right for our state. Focus on the next generation and not just the next election.
For more, we're joined by Nyla Boodoo, who hosts The 21st, a statewide public radio program produced by Illinois Public Media. Hi, Nyla.
Hey, Jeremy.
And so far, it looks like in this special legislative session, not a lot is getting done. What's been happening?
Right, Jeremy. Actually, it's an interesting thing. There's some state reporters who are even taken to calling this, political reporters are calling it a sham session, because the actual part of a session, you might think there's lawmakers who are meeting and talking about everything. They're just gaveling in for a couple of minutes most days. Literally, I'm talking about like 7 to 10 minutes. But what we do, what happens is they then leave and they kind of are then working out backroom deals, which is basically the only way this will get done. And yesterday, we did actually see leaders meeting, Democrats and Republicans, and the significant thing that reporters are reading into the tea leaves is after the meeting, they're not talking very much, which for us is a good sign because it means they're not complaining about each other that much. They're really trying to work out a deal, hopefully.
What is the fundamental disagreement here between the Republican governor and the Democratic legislature?
Well, Governor Rauner has for 3 years, Jeremy, had this turnaround agenda he's had that he wants to reform the state. And he said we can't have a budget without it. He's whittled that down. He had a huge list of things. He's down to about half a dozen issues now. But what he wants, there's reform on things like workers' compensation, term limits, property tax freezes. They don't necessarily have to do with a budget. But he's saying, I won't sign a budget until we get agreement on these other issues.
And the Democrats say, no way.
The Democrats are saying House Speaker Michael Madigan, who has been in office, by the way, longer than you and I have been alive, he has been in the Illinois House. He has said these would hurt the middle class in Illinois. These are deals that would harm people. And he's saying, no, I don't want to do this.
And meanwhile, as this stalemate has gone on over the last couple of years, the state has really struggled more than most other states in this country economically.
Oh, I mean, I think struggle is probably an understatement, Jeremy. It's pretty much a disaster. I mean, if you look at our credit rating, we're close to junk rating. A year ago, there was one study that said 1 million people in Illinois, its poorest residents, had lost social services. We're looking at public universities facing a loss of national accreditation, K through 12 public school superintendents across the state saying they don't have money to open in the fall. I talked to a hospital yesterday, a CEO of a small hospital in southern Illinois. He's saying the state owes him $2 million for his hospital, and that's just for compensation for state workers who are coming to his hospital, and they're just not paying the insurance.
Hmm. So who do Illinoisans blame for this?
I think Illinoisans, Jeremy, as you know, I think Illinoisans don't have a very high opinion of government to begin with. And it's, I think who you blame depends on what party you're from. If you're a Republican, you blame the Democrats and you say that House Speaker Michael Madigan is the real power center in the state and he hasn't done anything to move the needle. If you're a Democrat, you blame Governor Rauner and you say that he's crippling particularly the public school system and social services, and he's the real problem here. So again, you know, kind of like a lot of our national issues, I think it probably depends what party you're from.
Although in Illinois, there are a lot more Democrats.
That's very true. That's very true.
So let's just play out the two possibilities. What if they reach a deal in the next day? Is that possible?
I think it's anything is possible, but I don't know that it's particularly likely. Governor Rauner has said he will continue to ask that lawmakers meet in a special session every day after these 10 days, through the weekend, through the 4th of July holiday, because Friday really is a big day, Jeremy. Friday, by the end of the day, is when, for example, there's more than 900 construction projects across the state. All of those workers get pink slips on Friday. There's even lottery sales. Powerball sales stopped being sold in Illinois last night because it's a multi-state lottery and there's no appropriation to pay them. Hmm. And by the way, if anyone buys an Illinois lottery ticket and you win more than $25,000, the state says they don't know when they're going to pay you.
And what if there is no deal by the end of the week?
that's a really tough thing, right? Because this is where we've been basically for this is the third year that we've been in this situation where there has not been a permanent budget. I do think what we've seen in the past have been sort of stopgap measures where they pass six-month things. Both parties have said that's something they're very opposed to. They really do want to have a full budget in place. I think lots of people are hopeful now, especially over the past 24 hours, that maybe they're actually talking together. Maybe there's a possibility by next week they could get together to form a budget. But at this point, Jeremy, we're almost 3 years into this. I don't think anyone's going to make any predictions about what will happen, other than that it will get worse for Illinois. That I am confident in saying. Things will just get worse for the state, and it's already very bad.
Very distressing situation in Illinois. Nyla Boudou, who hosts The 21st, that's a public radio program produced by Illinois Public Media. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, on a day when senators, Republicans in particular, are scrambling to find some kind of agreement on their health care bill, President Trump's personal tweets about MSNBC hosts Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough are taking the oxygen out of Washington. This morning, Trump called Scarborough Psycho Joe and Brzezinski low IQ crazy Mika and said they insisted on joining him at Mar-a-Lago around New Year's Eve. He said no. She was bleeding badly from a facelift. Nebraska Republican Senator Ben Sasse tweeted, "Please just stop. This isn't normal, and it's beneath the dignity of your office." In a statement, MSNBC said, "It's a sad day for America when the president spends his time bullying, lying, and spewing petty personal attacks instead of doing his job." CNN tweeted, "We stand with Mika and Joe." But White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders defended the tweets on Fox News this morning.
"This is a president who fights fire with fire and certainly will not be allowed to be bullied by liberal media and the liberal elites within the media or Hollywood or anywhere else."
I get it.
Joining us now, NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, for people of that opinion who feel, look, it's a president who fights fire with fire, or why are we right now even talking about tweets? Why is this jumping out?
It's not fighting fire with fire. It's fighting fire with false personal attacks. It's got nothing to do with the merits of the arguments that are being made against the president. He's attacking Mika Brzezinski personally and for her looks and what appears to be – it's hard to argue that it's anything but sexist. And it's – you know, it is – if anybody other than the president of the United States were doing it, we'd say it's beneath contempt. So it's hard not to come to that same conclusion for the president. And certainly numerous senators of his own party are saying much the same today.
Yeah.
You know, he's responding, it appears, to a quote that she made, a remark she made this morning about this report, which was humorous and embarrassing for the president, that he had put up essentially fake Time magazine covers lauding him, lionizing him, that had been invented. And she said, this is a quote that people are pointing to today, quote, "Nothing makes a man feel better than making a fake cover of a magazine about himself, lying every day and destroying the country." Now, those are tough words. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they are not about his looks. They're about his actions and about his leadership. As president of the United States, you're open to that. Only he thinks it's illegitimate. And his defenders and really his apologists are the ones going out of their way to contort themselves to somehow make this about the journalistic practices of the media.
Well, Fox News was holding an interview with Sarah Huckabee Sanders. They waited about 9 minutes after the tweets to bring them up. But host Bill Hemmer pushed back. Here's part of one exchange.
"The president, again, isn't going to be somebody who's bullied and allows people himself and those around him to be personally attacked."
He would argue that he's always going to punch back and he's not going to fire the first shot. And perhaps he feels the criticism toward him is unwarranted.
I mean, the outrageous attacks that take place on that show day in, day out, not just at the president and not against his policies, not against things that he's pushing, but they're personal and they're not just directed at him, but again, everyone around him.
Look, this came during an intensification of attacks on the media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN. David, I'm reading my Twitter feed. It's on fire with people saying this is to deflect from a failed health care bill, and it could have political implications. On CNN, Republican Congressman Tom Reed of New York was asked about the tweets and how they might affect the stalled debate over the health care plan.
"Well, obviously, I was just made aware of that tweet and don't know the context or the exchange, but obviously concerned about that type of language. And maybe the intent is to distract from the health care debate, but I want to be part of the debate that's impacting the American people."
Well, David, the GOP needs to win over two female Republican senators, Lisa Murkowski and Maine's Susan Collins. Collins tweeted this morning, "This has to stop."
Listen, you cannot argue that Donald Trump is a grand master strategist. You know, he is a gut fighter and boxer and puncher. And, you know, even the spokeswoman for his the first lady, Melania Trump, said today, if you're going to hit him effectively, she said, if you're going to hit him, he's going to come back hit 10 times harder. As Jake Tapper, CNN, pointed out this morning, you know, Melania Trump is supposedly spearheading a drive against cyberbullying, which what Donald Trump does, the president does on a fairly regular basis seems to exemplify on Twitter. So I think that what you have here is that, you know, he is frustrated at the moment. The Senate health care bill is registering support in about the teens, I guess, if you look at a number of polls, even lower in at least one other poll. And there is he's evincing frustration, but he's doing it on the most minute and personalized things possible. It is true that Mika Brzezinski made fun of what she called his little hands. It's been a source of mockery that he's had for years from satirists here in New York, and it has nothing to do with his governing. If you want to be president, yeah, you have to be able to take some of these lumps.
David Folkenflik, thank you.
The Syrian conflict is in its sixth year. Around 470,000 people have died, and ISIS has set up its de facto capital in Raqqa. In order to defeat ISIS in Syria, the U.S. has started arming Kurdish forces called the YPG. They're operating as part of the Syrian Democratic Forces, and since May, they've been getting ammunition, small arms, and vehicles from the U.S. That has infuriated Turkey, which sees the Syrian Kurds as an extension of a terror group that they've fought since the 1980s. Joining us now to talk about the ups and downs of arming the Kurds is Ranj Alaldin, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Doha. He's on Skype. And Nicholas Harris, a fellow in the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. And let me start with you, Nicholas Harris. The U.S. supplied arms to the Syrian Kurds. You think that's a good idea. Why?
The U.S. has a narrowly focused mission, which is to conduct the counter-ISIS campaign. And in order to facilitate the capture of ISIS's capital of Raqqa, the U.S. military is determined that it has the ability to maintain a limited supply of armaments to particular units within the Kurdish majority People's Protection units, which is within the larger Syrian Democratic Forces coalition. And this is a focused mission. It's not about providing a blank check or an open inventory of weapons for Syrian Kurds. It is about empowering certain elements of the Syrian Democratic Forces coalition that will be in the beginning, in the tip of the spear of the campaign to conquer Raqqa.
Ranj, you say this could backfire spectacularly on the U.S.
Well, I think Nicholas said the word that I've been thinking of, which is a narrowly focused mission. The problem here is not so much what the U.S. does. I think everybody agrees the YPG is the most effective Western-friendly force capable of confronting ISIS, capable of liberating Raqqa. The problem is what the U.S. Isn't doing, and that's adding a political component to its strategy, its engagement. You need to have an ally that is willing to engage with other actors, that is inclusive, that engages with the principles of good governance, of the rule of law, because if that does not happen, then that actor will become a liability in the future. There will be multiple conflicts, challenges, and problems to deal with once Raqqa is liberated.
Well, what about the issue that's come up time and time again when the U.S. arms a group to try to achieve its military goals, which is that some of the people that we arm end up fighting against us?
Well, I think with the Syrian Kurds in general, whether that's the YPG or the other multiple Kurdish actors, the U.S. will have no problems there, because historically, the Kurds have generally been Western-friendly, Western-aligned actors. They've generally looked to the U.S. As a superpower that can give them that legitimacy. The YPG is a secular force at the same time as well. Its ideology isn't orientated around attacking the U.S. or attacking Western targets. So unlike, for example, some of the Islamist groups you have in Syria, the YPG certainly doesn't fit into that category of anti-Western, anti-American ideals.
Nicholas, do you agree that there's not a risk that by arming the YPG that later on they'll end up using those weapons against U.S. interests?
I agree that the YPG is an unlikely force to turn its weapons against the United States. The U.S. has a real opportunity here to try to promote an authentically pluralistic governance in an area of Syria that has historically been repressed. There is a real need for the Trump administration to define what it wants to do with territory that's been conquered from ISIS and how, if it wants to continue to maintain a residual U.S. force in eastern Syria, how it plans to prevent communal conflict in this area so that there can be a stable area of Syria, and you have a local security force that represents the various different communities that have raised their hands and said, yes, we want to fight with the U.S. against ISIS, and we look for a better future for Syria.
But some people may hear you say that and think, well, isn't that what we've kind of been trying to do in Iraq and Afghanistan? And it hasn't really worked out the way that people would have liked.
Well, the issue at hand is that the Obama administration made the decision in the end of 2014 that it wanted to conduct a counter-ISIS campaign via a quote-unquote light footprint approach, which means it minimizes the number of U.S. Soldiers on the ground in Syria. So it decided to go with to build up a local Syrian partner force, to make it a multi-ethnic force, and to support that force as it went and conquered territory from ISIS. Unfortunately, neither the Obama administration nor, it seems at this point, the Trump administration has really thought through what is the price of success for the U.S.-led coalition in Syria. In some respects, the U.S. could end up, by the end of the counter-ISIS campaign, over de facto control or influence over 40% of Syria's territory and a quarter of its population. And that presents numerous challenges for what is the phase four, or the post-ISIS governance consolidation security building phase. And I agree with the idea that if the U.S. is going to invest in these local Syrian partners, there may need to be a real detailed articulation from the Trump administration of how it plans to make sure that that area of Syria that is conquered from ISIS will be stable and will minimize conflict and will be able to provide for their people.
Ron Jalaluddin, what are your thoughts on the idea of whether you can really successfully outsource a fight to another group and have it work out for you in the end?
I mean, I don't blame any American or anybody else that points towards the blood on the treasure that has been spilt in places like Iraq. There's been billions of dollars invested in Iraq, in the state, and the country has very little to show for it. But I think in this particular case, ISIS did represent an imminent threat, not just to the region, but we've seen with the number of recent attacks that it is a transnational, international terrorist group that has the capacity to either direct or inspire attacks in America and so forth. So something had to be done, hence the triggering of the U.S.-led military campaign against ISIS. Now, in the case of the Kurds, you do have reliable actors that are capable of militarily defeating these groups. But as we saw in Iraq, what we really did there was contain the threat of terrorism. We never really eliminated the threat itself. We never really suppressed fully the space that allows these groups to thrive, to operate.
Well, let me ask you, Nicholas, about Turkey's objections to the U.S. arming the YPG. This is the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, after the U.S. made its announcement about arming them.
So our intent is to work with the Turks, with alongside one another, to take Raqqa down, and we are going to sort it out, and we'll figure out how we're going to do it, but we're all committed to it. We will work it out to our NATO allies and ours best way forward. War sometimes doesn't give you all good options. That's the nature of war.
Is it worth upsetting the Turks to this degree in order to arm the YPG?
Well, the Obama administration and the Trump administration have both made the calculation that the alliance with the Syrian Democratic Forces Coalition, of which the YPG is a part, is valuable for conducting the counter-ISIS campaign. If the U.S. objective in Syria is to defeat ISIS, however it defines that, and then to walk away, then you could see an expansion of the Turkish zone of influence that has been formed in northern Syria, which in and of itself would cause conflict with the local Kurdish community, which does not want to see expansion of the Turkish zone and also the placement of Turkish-backed militias in their areas. Or alternatively, if there is U.S. investment, and I agree that there, if there is U.S. investment in supporting good governance, in promoting local economies, in trying to create a genuinely pan-sectarian, pan-ethnic security force that is representative of the local communities over which the federal northern Syrian region is being built. That's the SDF-built region of Syria,
right,
that's backed by the U.S. Then you may be able to mitigate over the long term potential conflict between Turkey and Syrian Kurdish areas. But it's a difficult challenge, and it's a dilemma.
Well, Ranj, let me just finally end with you and ask, how often does the U.S. or any other country that arms a group go back and get the arms when they're done with the conflict?
That's a very difficult question to answer. But I think for that, you would need to have a serious presence on the ground. We've seen historically that once you give armed groups, any armed group, whether it's the Kurds or the Arabs, Islamists, you name it, once you give them weapons, it becomes extremely difficult to take it back. Because, unless you have the mechanisms in place, you need to have the physical presence to physically get hold of the weapons.
Right.
But also, if the mechanisms aren't in place and agreed upon between the respective parties, you can't get those weapons back. Because, and by mechanism specifically, I mean what happens if the armed group doesn't give the weapons back? What happens in that case? Are there penalties? Are there repercussions? And the U.S. simply isn't in a position to demand of the YPG that it gives those weapons back. So I think that's probably posturing just to please the Turks and other opponents of the decision to arm the YPG.
That's Ranj Alaldin, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Doha. We've also been speaking with Nicholas Harris, a fellow in the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks very much. Pleasure.
Thank you.
It's been a good summer to stand outside Major League ballparks. You can catch something. Hitters are swinging for the fences. We're not even halfway through this season, and there have already been nearly 3,000 homers. If the pace continues, they'll set an all-time record for homers in a single season. Right now, the record is 5,693 runs hit during the 2000 baseball season. So what's up? Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, Ken Davidoff writes in the New York Post, there are three components to a home run: ball, bat, player. What do you think's going on?
Wow, that's trenchant analysis. There are, of course, a number of factors, and we could go through a lot of them. But I think what is likely going on, and it can be a combination of things, this can be what they call an overdetermined phenomenon, but I think there's something called the fly ball revolution. And what it is that batters themselves are literally attempting to hit more home runs. Now, you would say, well, that doesn't make sense. Why wouldn't batters always attempt to hit home runs? Time was, if you asked a batter, were you trying to hit a home run on that, they would always say, no, I was just trying to get a good line drive. I'm trying to hit it as far as well as I can. And if it goes out of the park, it goes out of the park. But then they started measuring these things, and it turns out that the batters who have a launch angle, in other words, they kind of have a little more of an uppercut, are much more successful at hitting home runs. Exit velocity, which is the speed of the ball off the bat, comes into play. And this was known for a while, but it's really pervasive now, and these stats are often on TV and on highlights. And as some players see other players adjust their swings to more of an uppercut, and certain players have become superstars, having tweaked their swings, I think of Josh Donaldson, it becomes the newest trend. I'm going to try to swing for the fences, and literally it's working. But there are other phenomena at stake, too.
Well, David Duff does go a little deeper. He talks about pitching or batting coaches seeing seams that are different on the ball or stronger grains of wood in the bat. But is there concern that, you know, anything's juiced, including the player?
Okay, there are Justin Verlander, Tigers pitcher, was talking about the ball. There's nothing. There are seams literally holding it together, but he's saying that, you know, you used to be able to really feel them on your fingers, and now you can't. And they did a lot of studies if the balls are different, and the balls may be different. I don't think that's been demonstrably ruled out, especially last season when there was a huge uptick in home runs in the middle of the season. That never happens. As far as PEDs, there's a very good testing protocol in place. That doesn't mean they're not used performance enhancers. In fact, we know they are, because players get suspended. On the other hand, players are getting suspended. And the weird thing is, we always conflate performance enhancing or steroids with bulk and home runs. But, you know, proportionally, more people who are suspended, more players who are suspended are pitchers. So they maybe have been getting, or at least the ones caught, have been getting helped more by performance enhancers, which would seem to indicate that the home runs would be going down. And also small, slight players use PEDs. I think of D. Gordon suspended for 80 games. This guy hardly hits any home runs. So PEDs can help you do a lot of things besides hit the ball out of the park.
But I want to make sure you get this in the seconds we have. Players are running fast.
They are running faster. They have a good metric that measures speed in terms of feet per second. And in general, the best stolen base players are the fastest players. But I love Paul Goldschmidt, who's a first baseman. He has 122 bases in his career. The average rate of a major league player is 27 feet per second. He runs 0.1 seconds slower than that. He's slower than average and one of the base stealers because he's very smart about how he steals.
And very smart. Mike Pesca, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
The House Energy and Commerce Committee has approved a bill aimed at restarting a massive underground repository for nuclear waste. Yucca Mountain is about 100 miles from Las Vegas and was designated as the country's long-term storage site for nuclear waste back in 1987. But decades of opposition have mothballed the project, and it has been unused for years. Proponents of the plan have allies in the administration of President Trump. For more on this, we're joined by Yvonne Gonzalez, a reporter with the Las Vegas Sun. Hi, Yvonne.
Hello.
And how significant is this vote in the Energy and Commerce Committee?
Well, it's moving forward a piece of legislation that Nevada really, really, really doesn't want, and that while this repository project could go forward without the legislation, this really sets it up so that the project really pushes forward. It's been hemmed in by the fact that, you know, depending on the administration and the way the wind is blowing, they receive funding or don't receive funding, and as of now, after the Obama administration, the project's been completely dismantled. So this bill really pushes that forward.
And one of the people who was very much against this project was Harry Reid, who was the Senate minority leader. So is his departure one of the reasons why this is starting to pick up speed again?
I think it's a combination of factors, and the fact that he's no longer there. He was always a really strong voice against the project, but he definitely had an ally in the administration. And it really is about the purse strings. I mean, basically, if you choke off funding to a project, it can't go forward. And that's the tactic that they've used. And so this time around, it's really a combination of having support top down to just push forward with a project to store the country's nuclear waste, and everyone seems to think that that project needs to be Yucca Mountain.
And what is going on at Yucca Mountain right now, or what has been going on over all of these years when the project has been stalled?
So a couple of the experts who have been working on that here in Nevada say that if the project were to move forward, that facility would actually need to have some work done on it because the infrastructure that's been put in place so far is so old. This has been going on for decades. So they see some concerns with the facility itself having just sat there basically doing nothing for all these years.
As you have said, there's a lot of opposition to this in Nevada. Senator Catherine Cortez Masto, who's a Democrat, said in a statement on Wednesday, it's unjust and unfair to force Nevadans to live next to a nuclear waste dump. And the Nevada governor, Brian Sandoval, who's a Republican, said the Trump administration's budget request was a complete blindside. He's called the plan ill-conceived, irresponsible, and likely illegal. Is there anything that these Nevada politicians can do at this point to stop this?
They're trying on several levels, actually, and there are some lawsuits right now that are currently just on hold while the licensing process for the Regulatory Commission is on hold, and Nevada is weighing in on a Texas lawsuit. Texas is suing the federal government, saying that they have shirked their responsibility to safely store the nation's nuclear waste, and so Nevada is weighing in on that lawsuit, you know, basically saying, you know, we have a seat at the table. This is an issue about about Nevada. And so they're weighing in on that and basically pushing on all legal fronts. The Attorney General, Governor Sandoval, and all of these various agencies in the state that are working on this are actively pushing to make sure that this doesn't happen. And they've been actively pushing on that front for several decades.
What are people saying who are in favor of opening up Yucca Mountain and allowing the federal government to store nuclear waste there?
Nye County and eight other rural Nevada counties are actually very interested in getting the licensing process restarted. They want to hear the science behind it, and they want to potentially see, I guess, what the bright side could be if the project were to actually come to fruition in Nevada, what it would mean for jobs, what it would mean in terms of constructing the facility, and what it would mean in terms of bringing in federal dollars.
That's Yvonne Gonzalez, a reporter with the Las Vegas Sun. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, to Alaska now, where the Anchorage Petroleum Wives Club has been around longer than Alaska's been a state. The club was founded in 1957 after the first big oil discovery in Alaska to welcome the wives of oil workers flooding in. But a lot has changed since then, so the Anchorage Petroleum Wives Club recently decided it's time to rebrand. Elizabeth Harbaugh of Alaska's Energy Desk has the story.
At the Lakefront Hotel in Anchorage, a few dozen women gather for a working lunch.
This right here is our ballot for some...
Really, a voting lunch. Anchorage Petroleum Wives Club President Linnea Ward greets the women from behind a small cardboard ballot box.
You could complete it and then put the form here in the ballot box. That would be great.
As it turns out, it's a historic vote. After nearly 60 years as the Petroleum Wives Club, the members decide unanimously to update the name.
I am proud to announce that in 2017, we are going to have, through a unanimous vote of 23-0, our membership has voted to change our name to the Anchorage Petroleum Women's Association, effective June 1st.
Club President Linnea Ward says there are several reasons for the rebranding. One is that petroleum wives might paint a misleading picture in some people's minds.
I don't know if this was true, but supposedly the gossip throughout the organization was that we were approached by some reality show wanting to talk about, you know, they do the desperate housewives of Orange County or whatever. And so there was an interest in doing some wives thing of, you know, Anchorage, and that's just not us.
The Petroleum Wives want you to know they're not a group of cocktail-sipping, pearl-wearing socialites, although some do get together for a ladies' night out now and then. Take Ward, for example. Her husband may work for Conoco, but she's a PhD. This spring, Ward earned her doctorate in public communication and technology. She wrote her dissertation on the Petroleum Wives. She theorizes the group changed its name because the petroleum industry has changed. Ward says she's one of a growing number of club members who work.
We're not all these super wealthy, just trying to throw money out there, or we're trying to destroy the earth one step at a time. And we're trying to make our way in this world. We're trying to give back. We're trying to find meaning.
In addition to getting together for activities like hiking, playing cards, and making crafts, the Petroleum Wives also spend time volunteering and raising money for local charities. But increasingly, the meetups have to be scheduled around the 9-to-5 workday. Ward says another reason the club changed its name is to welcome a new kind of member.
My name is Anna Belanger. I'm a petroleum geologist for Glacier Oil and Gas.
There are lots more women working in Alaska's oil industry than when the club started in the 1950s. The Petroleum Wives recently changed its rules to allow oil industry workers to become president or vice president of the club. Belanger says replacing wives with women in the name means a lot to her.
I thought, well, my husband is actually a fisherman, sport fishing on the Kenai River. He's not in the oil industry. Am I able to join the organization?
Belanger says she appreciates meeting other women who understand the industry's ups and downs. After oil prices crashed in 2015, many companies announced mass layoffs. Member Zoe Smith's husband was retired from BP by then, but she says during the downturn, petroleum wives came together to help each other cope.
Especially the older ladies like myself, we've been through these cycles before. Someone else's husband got laid off. So you have a little bit someone else to talk to and work it through. And it just gives support that maybe you don't find with your neighbor because they don't really understand.
The petroleum wives kept meeting throughout the tough times, even after losing about 80 members, close to a third of its membership. Today, they're still going strong. Back in April, about a dozen members got together to make Easter goodie bags for a homeless youth shelter in Anchorage. Holly Lee organized the get-together. Lee's husband, an oil industry engineer, was transferred from Canada to Alaska in 2012. It's pretty common for oil companies to move employees every few years. Lee says finding friends in Anchorage wasn't easy at first, but then she joined the Petroleum Wives Club.
We are often, many of us, out of our own country. We're away from our family, like so many people who live in Alaska. And so this group provides a connectivity that I desperately needed.
Lee says some might argue the Petroleum Wives should have changed their name years ago. But she says for some of the members, the name represented a long tradition of women forging close friendships over their shared connection to the oil industry. And in that way, the Anchorage Petroleum Women's Association hasn't forgotten its roots. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
And Elizabeth's story comes to us from Alaska's Energy Desk, a public media collaboration focused on energy and the environment. President Trump welcomes the new president of South Korea to the White House tonight. You remember there was a snap election after the last president left in a scandal. Moon Jae-in arrives as tensions on the Korean Peninsula escalate, North Korea boasting of soon having a nuclear-armed missile that can reach the U.S. Sung-yeon Lee is professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts. He joins us now. Professor Lee, welcome.
Thank you.
So President Moon, the new South Korean president, was said to be more aligned with a previous president's sunshine policy toward the North and North Korea. Start there. What was that? And where does President Moon stand on North Korea, probably the most important issue?
The moniker sunshine policy comes from one of Aesop's fables. The sun and the north wind have a contest to see who's stronger, who can get the man on the street wearing a heavy winter coat to take it off. The wind huffs and puffs, the man holds on to his coat, the sun beams his warm rays and gets the man voluntarily almost to take it off. The idea behind it was through engagement, generous aid, and gradual reform, South Korea sought to change North Korea. This policy was in place between 1998 and 2008. The jury is still out on it, but I think a lot of people feel that that kind of unconditional aid, no questions asked, billions of dollars in aid, did not get very far.
And certainly President Trump would not be a sunshine policy kind of guy. So what's your anticipation of how the two might square that, or if they'll even bring it up? Some are saying that there may not be policy discussions.
A summit meeting, especially one among between allies, are usually routine, somewhat prosaic affairs. There are pronouncements of reaffirmation of the alliance, ironclad, and so forth. But underneath this particular meeting, there is some tension. And I think it's quite likely that there might be some frosty moments. It might not be at summit meeting just overflowing with bonhomie. Why? Because there have been such tense meetings between U.S. President and South Korean President just 2 years ago. Park Geun-hye, who was recently removed from office, Ms. Park, she visited President Obama in October 2015, and she was one with true bona fides when it came to South Korea's support for the United States and also her less than favorable view of North Korea, the communist regime. However, because Ms. Park had attended a major Chinese weapons parade celebration on the occasion of the 70th anniversary of China's purported victory over Japan in early September 2015, which was attended by various dictators of the world, President Obama admonished President Park and said, when China breaks international norms and rules, I expect South Korea to call China out on that. Why? Because post-war international norms and rules have been very good for South Korea. So I think, you know, with the unpredictable nature of President Trump and also what's known of President Moon, that he tends to be somewhat more favorably disposed toward North Korea, we can expect a little bit of tension.
Well, there's also tension, we understand, over the anti-missile system that the U.S. recently installed in South Korea. The U.S., of course, has American troops stationed there. This anti-missile system was said to be to protect them from a possible attack by North Korea. But China's not very happy about that. They think it might be used offensively against them. So talk a little bit about how that might come up.
Yes, that's a crucial issue because this sophisticated U.S. anti-missile defense system called THAAD, it's been controversial. Moon Jae-in, President Moon's special advisor, just 2 weeks ago in Washington said that THAAD was primarily intended to protect U.S. troops in South Korea, suggesting that it didn't apply to the defense of South Korea or South Koreans, which is somewhat absurd. And this has been a useful gambit to President Moon in the run-up to his election victory because it was a way to placate China, which is strongly opposed to South Korea's deployment of THAAD, and also it was a way to send a signal to North Korea that he would be amenable to re-engaging North Korea in dialogue. And I think for President Trump, he may be willing to bend more, make concessions on economic issues, but when it comes to the lives of U.S. troops, I don't think he's willing to compromise.
Yeah. Professor, President Trump has done a lot of chest thumping towards North Korea. What's your sense of how South Korea feels about that? What might they welcome? You know, maybe even a military confrontation with North Korea? Or is that the last thing they want, given the horrendous war, you know, they all went through? What's your sense?
South Korea is in a very difficult position, of course. It has to sort of coexist with North Korea. And in truth, no one wants a war. Chest thumping, show of force, these are necessary aspects of sending a strong message of deterrence both ways. At the same time, chest thumping without real policy doesn't get you very far. I don't think there's a strong high possibility of the United States using military force against North Korea anytime soon, for the very simple reason that it's never been tried since the end of the Korean War in 1953. We know that North Korea is no Syria, is no Iraq, is no Afghanistan. They have the intent and the capability to shoot back, and that's been a strong deterrent for the U.S. and South Korea.
Sun-Yung Lee, professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts. Professor Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.